From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
I want to say to you that the religious and political right in the United States represents an enemy of religion, true or authentic religion, and an enemy of democratic values.
Famed civil rights leader Reverend James Lawson speaks out against the religious right. And Priests for Life, the role of the religious right in the anti-choice movement. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Mississippi agreed yesterday to end more than a quarter century of legal battles over the desegregation of its higher education system, reaching a $500 million settlement intended to remedy decades of state-sanctioned racial discrimination. The agreement with the U.S. Justice Department and a group of black Mississippians could mark the end of a class-action lawsuit initiated in 1975 to desegregate the state's public colleges and universities. The lawsuit sought to improve academic programs and facilities at the state's three historically black universities: Jackson State, Alcorn State, and Mississippi Valley State. It alleged that those schools offered educational opportunities inferior to those at the state's five historically white universities because of Mississippi's history of racial discrimination. Families of nine Japanese men and boys killed when a U.S. submarine struck and sunk their training trawler off Hawaii voiced outrage on Tuesday at a decision forcing the captain to resign, saying it was too lenient. "I cannot find words to express my anger," said Teruo Tarata, uncle of 18-year-old Yusuke Tarata, lost in the February accident off Hawaii. In Honolulu, Commander Scott Waddell of the USS Greenville was reprimanded and ordered to resign on Monday, although with full pension. Hiroshima Ishibashi, mayor of the southwestern city of Uojima, was deeply dissatisfied with the decision. He told a news conference that it, quote, "causes nausea among the families and myself." This news from New Mexico. In Grants, New Mexico, authorities fired tear gas last night to break up a day-long protest by about 700 prisoners at a private prison. The prisoners, who were to be handcuffed, checked for weapons, and returned to their cells, said the state police. That was expected to take several hours. But the prisoners refused to leave the recreation yard or go to classes or work assignment in what the director of the marketing for Nashville, Tennessee-based Corrections Corporation of America called a nonviolent protest. The prison, which has a contract from the Federal Bureau of Prisons, has 818 prisoners, 766 of whom are federal prisoners. Germany began transporting nuclear waste to Britain for the first time in 3 years today after police cleared away 100 protesters attempting to block the road from a power plant. And the Indonesian president, Abdurrahman Wahid, has issued a decree establishing a special court to try Indonesian officers responsible for a wave of bloodshed when East Timor voted for independence in 1999. Thousands marched in Washington, D.C. this weekend for the largest abortion rights rally in recent years. They warned Congress members and President Bush not to roll back women's access to abortion and birth control. Meanwhile, tomorrow in New York, another major pro-choice rally is expected outside the Waldorf Astoria, where the National Right to Life Committee is honoring Frank Fallone, head of Priests for Life. Al Ross is with us from the Institute for Democracy Studies to talk about the significance of the event. Al Ross.
Morning, Amy.
Hi. The honoring.
The event in New York tomorrow evening marks a very important watershed in the struggle to defend women's reproductive rights. The event itself is, as you mentioned, a gala $500 a plate black tie dinner at the Waldorf Astoria, honoring New York Catholic priest Frank Provone, by the largest anti-choice organization in the country, the National Right to Life Committee. Frank Pavone, head of an organization called Priests for Life, has explicitly encouraged blockades of clinic doors and also explicitly justified criminal trespass against abortion clinics. The rally, which will start at 5:30 tomorrow evening at 50th Street and Park Avenue, is being called by a courageous New York State Senator, Eric Schneiderman, with support from New York Now, NARAL, Planned Parenthood New York City, and a host of other civil rights organizations concerned about women's reproductive
but
choice.
But why would it be so surprising that the National Right to Life Committee would be honoring Priests for Life?
Well, what's important here is that the National Right to Life Committee is one of the most important, enormous organizations in the country opposed to choice, but to date, it has avoided involvement in calls for militant direct action. The decision to honor Frank Pavone breaches that divide. The importance of the event should really be lost on no one. The National Right to Life Committee, since 1994, has received approximately $1 million from the Republican Party and Republican Party-affiliated organizations. And with the new administration in the White House, with an attorney general, the highest law enforcement agent in the country, saying, quote, "I believe Roe versus Wade was an original matter was wrongly decided, the challenge now for choice has never been greater." The backdrop to the event is not only now a consensus among this enormous organization, National Right to Life, to back militant direct action, but the backdrop comes from the National Council of Catholic Bishops itself. In 1998, this organization, representing all the Catholic bishops in the nation, issued a statement in which they said, "Laws that permit abortion are profoundly unjust, and because they are unjust, they cannot bind citizens in conscience, be supported, acquiesced in, or recognized as valid." Now, the National Right to Life Committee was originally, in the 70s, the committee, National Right to Life Committee of the National Conference of Catholic Bishops. It spun off as an independent status, but is still closely collaborating with the NCCB. In fact, the NCCB website today lists the event at the Waldorf Astoria on its agenda of events.
And the hosts of tomorrow night's event?
It's a coalition of organizations, as I mentioned, being called by now NARAL.
No, I mean of the actual, the honoring.
Oh, the host committee significantly includes Ed Meese and Robert Bork. Those of you who were listening to Democracy Now! Last week heard the discussion we had on the most important right-wing legal organization in the country, which is now taking over the legal apparatus of the Bush administration, called the Federalist Society.
Al Ross, on that note, we have to go. Director of the Institute for Democracy Studies.
And I say people who want to get our report on Priests for Life can contact us at www.idsonline.org.
And the phone number in New York of the Institute?
212-423-9237. Report's called Priests for Life, A New Era in Anti-Abortion Activism.
And you're listening to Democracy Now! Mahalia Jackson singing the 23rd Psalm here on Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The Bush administration is not only targeting the gains of women's rights movement, but also civil rights. Here again, the religious right is leading the assault. Reverend James Lawson, who was with Martin Luther King, one of the leaders of the civil rights movement, last week gave a speech on the role of the religious right today. He was giving the talk at Union Theological Seminary and was introduced by David Halberstam, the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author of The Best and the Brightest.
But I'm delighted to introduce a genuine American hero. There are people out there who say that there are no heroes anymore, and of course that's not true. It's just that the wrong people are looking in the wrong places. I mean, if you send Barbara Walters on prime time to California at the time of the Oscars, you're not going to get heroes. And if you let the people of the People magazine comb this city and this country for what makes us better, they'll not come up with anything extraordinary. But I've been luckier. I've gone to distant places, and I've seen some extraordinary people. And I'd like to, and Jim Lawson is one of my great heroes. I'd like to begin with a snapshot from 45 years ago, the fall of 1956, Oberlin College, a young minister named Harvey Cox, who will soon be, or someday be, head of the Divinity School at Harvard, is bringing up this ascending, talented, and brilliant young man named Martin King to speak at Oberlin. In fact, there's a great question as to which hall should they put him in. Is this a separation of church and state issue? Martin King is on the beginning of this remarkable journey that makes him the voice of everything that's best in America. And at the same time, back from 3 years as a missionary in India, as a young man, also black, also a minister's son, Methodist, not Baptist. You never quite got over the moat, Jim, with all those Baptist preachers. Jim Lawson, a man who has already spent time in a federal prison for refusing to register for the draft in the Korean War. And Harvey Cox thinks they should meet, and they do, and Jim Lawson, who has been stirred by the Montgomery bus boycott in the news reaching Africa and India, says, you know, he'd like one day to, when he finishes his divinity school studies, to come down there. And Martin King, hearing his background, this extraordinary background of someone who is already beginning to merge Gandhian faith with American Christianity, says, come now, we need you now. And it is a call, and Jim comes, and he comes to Nashville. In the fall and winter of 1959, 5 years after Brown versus Board of Education, when we were supposed to have all deliberate speed in public desegregation, all deliberate speed is very deliberate and not very speedy. Here is perhaps one black vote per county in the South can be registered, and perhaps one black graduate student can be integrated in the universities of the border states. And that is the picture when Jim Lawson comes in and takes these brilliant young American students, because this was, too many people think of it as a movement that is Martin King's, and not to denigrate his extraordinary memory, this was a mass democratic movement, and to the degree that it was a movement at all, it was a children's movement. And the architect of the children, the great teachers here tonight, and the first thing he taught them when they were only a handful of them, and they were scared, who are we in Nashville to go up against the powerful city fathers who have lawyers and they have big companies and money and they own the politicians, and who are we? We're a handful of black kids. Nobody cares about us. Our parents aren't powerful. They don't even can't make phone calls. Our parents don't even want us to protest. We are the first members of our family ever to get this far. We are putting at risk family dreams. And so they are nervous and they feel powerless. And Jim teaches them the Gandhian first law, and that is, yes, no one knows your name, but you have justice on your side. And so if you go out and do this just thing, the city fathers are going to have to make a choice. They can either accede to you or they can arrest you. And if they arrest you, you will no longer be anonymous. You will begin something. And where you are 20, there will be 40, and where there were 40, there will be 80, and where there were 80, there will be 200 and 300. And he's right. And it happens. And this extraordinary movement begins. And in this brief time, changes the country and changes it for the better. The second thing he taught them, it's hard to believe this now, was that in this time where there had been so much psychological suppression, the people who were doing this had no right to do it, that God was in all of them and that they were as good as anyone else, that it didn't matter how big a house they lived in or their enemies lived in. It didn't matter where the city fathers said they should sit in the bus or not eat at a restaurant, that God was in all of them and man could not take away these rights, that they had the right to do these things. And out of that came a great, great confidence and a great movement. And the man who really taught them is here tonight. I would like to acknowledge, and I will get out of your way in a second, but I would like to, while we are here tonight, acknowledge a great personal debt to him and to them. Because I was lucky enough to be a young reporter, neither of us had a single black hair back in February 1960, and you've gotten very gray. I was lucky enough to cover it. I became a better reporter there and a few years later in Vietnam, because if these young people who had been in this country so much longer than I had been and my family had been, and who had been so much less privileged, could take so much risk for the betterment of all of us, the betterment of the whole country, who was I not to take that risk as well? And they gave me something else, which is I have today, and that is an enduring faith in democracy, that it can work, that it can be challenged. So it is 41 years, or to be exact, 41 years and 2 months. You were my hero then, you are my hero now.
David Halberstam introducing the Reverend James Lawson at Union Theological Seminary.
I met Christian fundamentalism in the United States now over 55 years ago. When, as a Methodist young person growing up in Ohio and engaging in conference and regional youth workshops and conferences of various kinds, I came to learn for the first time of what we called then Christian fundamentalism, though I did not know that name for some years until some years later. But one of the things that perplexed me about it was this, that in the setting of a youth conference of the Methodist Church, the young Christian fundamentalists were persistent in saying to me that unless you have these four or five or six points, you're not saved. And by that time, there was in my life a growing mystic awareness of Jesus as the one to whom God had called me. And by that time, I was reading and examining carefully all of the scriptures, and especially the Gospels, literally every day. And there was no way at all that, in my life at least, the experience of God could make me assume that their system for my well-being was really a system for my well-being at all. And from that time on, I started taking a keen interest in listening to that perspective. When I reached college in 1947, there was a wonderful, young, attractive sophomore that I came in touch with through some of the religious activities on campus. And lo and behold, It turned out that Bill was also a fundamentalist, and Bill would often come to my dorm room at 10 o'clock at night or 11 o'clock at night because he liked me, I liked him. But he was afraid, in fact, he knew that I was not quite at all in the kingdom, that I wasn't there. And so he persisted for the better part of two quarters of school, convinced me. Well, as I've followed them, I have then read deeply. I did one sabbatical in the early 70s in which I simply went and read everything that Billy Graham had written. Not because I didn't know some of it, but because I wanted to have a thorough examination of that picture. I have since read many, many documents. I've followed Pat Robinson, especially, and Gerald Falwell, and Jim Dobson, and James Kennedy. Now, the point I want to make this evening to you who are religionists of different styles and places is a simple point. I want to say to you that the religious and political right in the United States represents an enemy of religion, true or authentic religion, and an enemy of democratic values.
The Reverend James Lawson speaking at the Union Theological Seminary. We're going to spend the program listening to this talk, but first break for stations to identify themselves here on Democracy Now! You're listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers, as we go back to the speech of the Reverend James Lawson speaking about the religious right.
They are an ideological, closed system of thought, and there's no way whatsoever that you can get involved in, quote, a dialogue or a conversation that's going to mean anything of significance. Their purpose is not helping the world to become a better world for all humankind. Their purpose is to gain domination and control and management of the world so that their perspective and their understanding of the world order will prevail. And all who do not agree with it are to be vanquished in various sorts of ways. Pat Robinson has said this over and over again in his books and on the 700 Club. America should be a theocracy in which all who are elected and all who are appointed to office are Christian people of my stripe. He doesn't say of my stripe, but that's what he means. He considers no compromise in that position. The thrust of the Christian right towards theocracy and tyranny. And Dr. Pixon here this evening, in her very calm fashion, demonstrated to us a form of the tyranny that is represented in the Christian right. We must not compromise. Therefore, I was delighted when I learned that there was an Institute of Democratic Studies and that they saw as their first task the studying of the religious right in the mainstream denominations and their effort to unpack who they are, where the money comes from, to unpack the various connections between the various boards of directors of the different religious right and political right groups, and to indicate the extent to which their agenda is, in fact, a paid agenda that is convinced that they can take over the Presbyterian Church and control it and the United Methodist Church and so forth and so on. I've watched them in my own denomination, the United Methodist Church, and I've long been a voice in opposition to what they offer us. The Good News Caucus, the Institute for Religion and Democracy, and the Alternate Mission Society, now the Confessing Church movement in the United Methodist Church, are not interested in any kind of dialogue. They are not interested in seeing sowing the seeds for a renewal and transformation and personal and social revolution in the spirit of a Jesus. They are interested only in domination. I have watched it there very carefully. In the 60s and the 70s, they were attacking the United Methodist Church because of its communist leanings. They, in the 70s, increased that as the women's division of the United Methodist Church gained strength and power and diversity, and also gained a spirituality that insisted that they would see the application of that spirituality to all of the issues which affect women and children and the poor and the people of color and the people in other parts of the world. Then the women's division became an instrument of the communists, and this was their persistent, steady attack. They did it in all sorts of church meetings. They came to the board of Global Ministries and said this and did this. They formed the Alternate Society, a mission society, because they were saying that the board of Global Ministries no longer had a missional sense of the gospel, and that local churches should send missionary money for overseas work through them. Well, what that has always been about, in my own contention from 25, 30 years ago, is very simple. At one time, missions, at least the overseas missions of the United Methodist Church, of the Methodist Church, were strongly dominated by male voices from the South. They were the largest number of people who were the staff of that board. They managed the budget and so forth and so on. When I was approved as a missionary in 1951, it was an all-white male committee that approved me and accepted me as a member of the missionary staff. Now, under the aegis of change, creative and necessary change, especially in the 60s, as the Board of Missions, now the Board of Global Ministries, became a highly diverse board with all kinds of people on it from the United States, and then, in addition to that, put on it all sorts of people from around the world, and where the folk from around the world began to have more of a voice on helping to shape the understanding of mission in the church through the Board of Global Ministries, the outrage against the board increased, not because that was not the work of the Spirit, but because their very narrow identification of the Spirit was that the mission task of the church can only be trusted to those who are white, primarily male, Western-oriented, with their particular theocratic understanding of God and of the world and of the church. That's what they're doing, and that's what they're after. And in the mainstream church, I want to say, there can be no compromise. They must be resisted unless we expect to have disaster in the churches and in our nation as a whole. That's, it seems to me, what I simply want to say as powerfully as I can to you. In church and in state, the religious right intends to become the dominant force, not for good and certainly not for compassion, but to try in their minds to restore some traditional old order, which is the old order of caste and race and class and structural poverty and greed. Now, very briefly, I want us to learn wisdom from our past, because the wisdom of the past should tell us, number one, that the violence in the early colonial days that decimated the Native Americans and instituted slavery and reaffirmed the oppression of women did not produce in this nation, did not establish justice or produce in this nation domestic tranquility. Now, through all of those years, the strain, of course, from many politicians and also many preachers was that this is the greatest experiment ever, that this is the greatest nation ever, that we will be indeed the opportunity for leadership in the whole world one day. In spite of that, that push that far too many Americans continue to hold to today, in those many decades, the vision either of the Declaration of Independence or the vision of the Constitution, the preamble of the Constitution, never became real for a vast majority of the people of the land. And I want to insist that where we are today in our society, I won't repeat much that has already been said, but we are a society with cultures of violence and cultures of racism and cultures of greed and materialism and cultures of a culture of sexism, a culture of addiction. And these spiritual forces of wickedness, which confuse and shape the minds of so many people in our land, including we of the churches, also cannot produce justice or hope for the world in which we live. And so the major thesis I want to lift this evening is that every step towards the lifting of the quality of life for the ordinary person in this land has not come by decree from the politicians or Congress or governors or legislative bodies. Every little or large step for liberty or justice or community came because of the uprising of ordinary people. From the beginning wobbling efforts to create religious liberty did not come from James Madison. It came from the Mary Dyers hung on the Boston Commons in 1660 and the Roger Williams preaching in the jails of Virginia and refusing
to go along with the established church colonies across the 13 colonies. The slaves running away, the abolitionist movement, the voices of the Frederick Douglasses, who, and the Harriet Tubmans and others who insisted that slavery was immoral and had to be changed and had to be ended. The voices of women and working people in the last half of the 19th century. The voices of the church folk who insisted that child labor needed to end. The women marching, spending Christmas in jail in Washington, D.C. as they demanded the right to vote in the 1920s, early 20s, 1919 and beyond. These are the movements that cause political action to lift the horizon of this people towards a democratic society, towards a vision of governance by and for and with the people. The working people, our parents and grandparents and great-grandparents, who in the 20s and the 30s carried on with the tramping of their feet in lock-ins and sit-ins and strikes and boycotts of all kinds by the tens of thousands year after year. They were the voices that caused Roosevelt and Eleanor Roosevelt and others to determine that there had to be a new deal that would impact the average American. It was not Congress that got the idea. It was the people. And you must see the movement of the 50s and 60s, the movement for which I think King was a symbol, as having the same historical charge. As Lou has already said, and as Francis has already said, it was that movement that pushed ideas for the great society and saw past the finest array of progressive literature, of progressive legislation that this nation had ever passed. That, it seems to me, is the weight of the movement. And in saying that, then, I want to try to urge that if we are to resist the theocratic notions and the ideological notions of who we are and what kind of land we can become, and the welfare issue is a simple illustration of the disaster being spread, and not simply a disaster, but the invisibility of the disaster to the media and to the churches and to large numbers of people in our society, because racism and violence and sexism have a spiritual seed that they plant in us, and that seed is blindness to the neighbor, so that we let all sorts of people become invisible. And so the movement of the 50s and 60s asked a singular question: where do we go from here, chaos or community? And it has to be said that chaos has increased for a great variety of reasons, but one of the reasons is the assault from the right, and the assault from the religious right in particular. Let me remind you that Trent Lott and Pat Robinson are men who lived in the 60s and are my peers. And all through the 60s, Martin King or Joe Lowry were communist. They were enemies. They were traitors. They were unpatriotic, all who participated in that struggle. And I shall never forget something that William Buckley wrote as he watched the unfolding of that movement. He wrote that as one saw the continuing drama and struggle in the South of the movement to desegregate and so forth and so on. He said, people like myself must wish for the victory of white civilization. And it is then that the Trent Lotts and the Bill Buckleys and the Bill Rushers and a host of others began to meet and plot and unite some of their forces and energy, began to attract money, began to create the foundation base that has poured millions of dollars into the rights effort.
Reverend James Lawson, longtime pastor at Holman United Methodist Church, currently loose lecturer at Harvard University Divinity School, speaking at the Union Theological Seminary in New York, and we'll come back to the conclusion of his speech in just a minute. And by the way, if you want to get a cassette copy of this program, you can call the archives at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Back in a minute. You're listening to Democracy Now! Free Speech Radio as we go to the conclusion of the speech of the Reverend James Lawson.
Civilized, does a white civilization need racism and sexism and violence? You wonder what kind of character thinks that white civilization can survive or prevail without justice or truth. Now, the forces that we must work to change, that we were working to change in the 60s, have not yet been dismantled or thoroughly confronted. But we must understand that democracy is a process in this land and not a sure thing. It's not a closed system. It is a journey of many stops and many beginnings of ebb and flow. And while indeed a George Bush has the upper hand, though gained the upper hand by a coup rather than by the will of an election, he cannot win, because I'm convinced, as never before, that the universe is not on the side of cruelty or injustice or tyranny. The universe is on the side of compassion and truth and the beloved community. It's on the side of human beings growing up into the full stature of the likeness and the image of God that is within us. And to grow up is to begin to see the world, and especially the human race, in little bits and pieces as God sees it, sees us and sees the world. The religious right assault is a threat to religious freedom and practice. And the Bush administration has been extremely smart, and we should understand that. And the effort to create, as you know, he has created a faith-based office. Now, that in itself is not a new idea. There are probably many, many roots that stretch back in public life, in the kinship and relationships with congregations and with churches. In the 1980s, the Reagan administration used a number of faith-based groups to supply the Contras in Nicaragua, and in fact used a number of faith-based groups even to participate in taking supplies to the Contras and bringing back other things, and even engaged, some of them even engaged in some of the massacres that took place in Nicaragua in the 80s. So the faith-based notion is not something new. Bush has lifted it up and put it in the White House and appointed the top officials for it. But I want you to notice the extent to which the faith-based effort is aimed at the black church and at black people. Because George Bush has somehow that silly notion that if he creates a daily-like machine in Washington that offers black congregations special access to his office, which he's doing, now has is appointing rather an advisory committee to the faith-based program, and it's 90%. I didn't count exactly, but by going and looking at it two or three times, it has about 90% of the clergy and the organizations are black church organizations. He wants to make inroads in the black community. But as Martin King said back in 68 in his Playboy interview, the white structures have always selected various black people, and King was very unkind. He said, put them in a suit and tie and white shirt, and then use their voices to speak the will of the powers that be, and not a concern for their own people. This is an effort to divide and rule, in other words. It is not a faith effort. Some of the voices who have been strongly supportive of the faith-based idea have spoken just as firmly and tenaciously against the Congressional Black Caucus, and they have tried to put to the side what they've called traditional civil rights leadership in the black community. So they've begun to frame the issue in a way that could bring dissension and the like into the black community in various ways. So I think that we must say that the faith-based idea as being formed and shaped now is to be a tool for patronage without any kind of commitment or awareness of the issues of justice or the issues of undergirding the community itself. A faith-based social program cannot care for the issues of poverty, racism, sexism, violence, addiction in our society. These institutions are institutions wrapped in public policy. They're wrapped in budgets. They're wrapped in the way in which the United States have operated across the last 50 years. They will not yield to band-aids and a little bit of feeding and the rest of it. The problems will persist because they will only respond to a motive and a program of justice. I would simply remind you that the task of religion is not only to lift a faith that is compassionate, inclusive, and embraces all, but perhaps the task that we have neglected the most is the task of challenging the forces of iniquity and insisting that justice must prevail, not the justice of our society, not 2 million people in prisons, mostly black, young, and poor, not the justice of 200 babies who die a day in the United States from lack of access to care. 200 a day, nearly 60,000 in this calendar year, within the first year of their birth, will die. This is not about faith-based charity. James Gilligan, in a very wonderful book that he's entitled Violence, describes this dying of the babies in America by using Boston as an illustration. He is on the medical school faculty at Harvard University and was for 25 years the head of the Department of Psychiatry in the prison system of Massachusetts, working primarily with the violent people in the business system. And he says something like this about the dying of babies in Boston. They die at the rate, black babies die at the rate of 14 times the dying of white babies in the first year of life. He calls that structural violence. He said we in the medical profession could declare a public health issue in this matter in the Boston area because we know how to stop this. And we could end that infant mortality tragedy. But then he goes on. A baby does not die in the first year of life because the mother is a good or bad mother, or because she has made certain mistakes or not made mistakes. Her decisions have very little to do with the dying of those babies because it is structural. It is in the system. And she cannot, by her decisions, do anything about the system. That is what I say about a faith-based program that's aimed at charitable choice and that Bush expects to use as a wedge in our country. Besides, I think there is foolishness in the Republican Party and even in the Democratic Party about this matter. I was born in a Republican family. My parents were both staunch Republicans. But I can remember as a youngster in the early 30s, sitting with the whole family in the living room in Massillon, Ohio, in front of the radio, listening to the speeches of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And I can remember to this day that when he said, "My fellow Americans," and when he talked about all Americans, I felt included. My parents did not switch their vote because of rhetoric or because Franklin Delano Roosevelt had a strong civil rights position or speech. I don't know if he ever made one. They switched their vote because in the Great Depression, as the programs unfolded for the people out of the ethos of the tramping of millions of feet, those programs included black people. Without a lot of fanfare, but included us. And we did not vote 90% for Gore because Gore was an excellent choice. But we have the best antenna in the nation in relationship to who in the White House best represents the interest of all the people, including us. I think we might take note of the fact that in this election last year, 90% of the black folk voted against Bush for Gore. 67% of the Jewish community voted against Bush. They voted for Gore. A majority of the Latinos and a majority of the Asians in this country all had the same antenna, the same vibrations. Maybe the future for social change and progress, maybe the future for progressive religion is building on that coalition and seeing that base as the soil out of which can come the new spirit for truth and democracy. The religious right cannot win. They will not form a more perfect union. They will perform chaos. They will not establish justice. They will extend and expand the cruelty and the injustice. They will not ensure domestic tranquility. They will increase the levels of violence of speech and hand and fist and gun and thinking and attitude. They will not promote the general welfare, the common good. They will promote the common welfare for corporations and the national security state. You've never seen anywhere in the literature of the religious or the political right a single war they did not applaud, or a single technological weapon for war that they did not think was a great idea. They will not secure blessings for the 21st century, for ourselves and for others. They will instead increase tyranny. I think that only by seeing them as our enemy, only by indeed then doing what the spiritual leaders of all generations have insisted, that there must be love and compassion for the enemy, will we be able to see who they are and what they are doing and build the forces that make a difference and can change them. They will not change through a general feel-good feeling. They will change only when we, the people, raise up a movement for justice and for truth in such a fashion that is in the best tradition of our people across 400 years. We'll so confound these spiritual forces of wickedness that we can plant the seeds for America moving away from this dangerous soil of tyranny, being the superpower dictator of the world and the military power of the world, and perhaps continue the process of extending democracy that includes every boy and every girl in every part of this nation of ours. I see that as the challenge, and I invite you, one and all, to participate in it. Thank you.
The Reverend James Lawson, longtime pastor at Holman Unitas Methodist Church in Los Angeles, currently teaching at Harvard University Divinity School. He spoke last week at Union Theological Seminary in New York at an event sponsored by the Institute for Democracy Studies. Its contact phone number is 212-423-9237. That's 212-423-9237. If you'd like to order a cassette copy of today's program, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. And if you'd like to email us, you can write to us at mail, M-A-I-L, at democracynow.org. That's mail at democracynow.org. You can also write to us a regular letter in the mail and send it to Democracy Now, 120 Wall Street, New York, New York, 1005. Democracy Now, 120 Wall Street, New York, New York, 1005. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams and Terry Allen. Anthony Sloan's our engineer. Errol Maitland, our technical director. From the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of The Band and the Fired, from the studios of our listeners, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.